All right, it's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for everyone for inviting me. A special thanks to Avery Broderick. I want to point out that Avery was the mastermind behind part of this particular day, and unfortunately he can't join us because he has COVID, but he's a very critical member of the EHG team, kind of led the whole team here in Perimeter, so I want to start off by just raising a virtual glass to Avery. Wish he were here with us today. So I'm going to talk about how to take a picture of a black hole. There we go. And I'm not going to bury the lead. We've taken a couple of pictures of black holes. The first one was announced in 2019. That's M87. It weighs 6.5 billion times what our sun does. And this is Sagittarius A star at the center of our Milky Way galaxy, which weighs about 4 million times the mass of our sun. These are results I'm presenting on behalf of the EHT collaboration. But later I'll tell you about a project called the Next Generation EHT, for which we hope to make movies of black holes and take this in a new dimension. The motivation behind this project really was twofold. One could be test Einstein's theory at one of the most extreme laboratories in the universe where Einstein's theories might break down. But then also, what could we learn about black holes by having access to the boundary itself? What could we learn about these monsters that lurk and exist in the centers of most galaxies? So that was the motivation behind everything. And to do this, we needed to develop all new instrumentation. We needed to harness telescopes around the world and bring together a team that spanned many, many nations. So I want to start off by describing what early results were on what a black hole should look like. And very early, Max von Laue in 1921, and even before him, Hilbert in 1916, started asking what the impact parameter of a black hole might be. What would it look like against a background of photons? And they realized that while the event horizon here, 2gm over c squared, has everything to do with the absorption of photons that would underplay the impact parameter, it was really this photon orbit that described the size of the shadow of the black hole. And that's because if you send photons in from infinity, the ones that just tangentially move around that photon orbit describe the impact parameter. Anything inside that will spiral into the event horizon, be lost forever. So the size of the event horizon was pretty well understood early on to be roughly the square root of 27 over 2 times the Schwarzschild radius. This is interesting. This gives a really strong prediction of what we should see based on just a handful of fundamental constants here. This is if the black hole is non-spinning. You get this relatively simple formula. And then James Bardeen, no stranger to the Perimeter Institute here, solved in 1973 the equations for a maximally spinning black hole, showing that it moves a little bit off to the side here, this impact parameter, flattens on one side, but generally maintains the same shape. It's insensitive to spin, really. And this is shown by an animation by one of our undergraduates, Joseph Farah, which shows that as the black hole spins up, the shadow shifts over to one side, and only at the very, very high spins do you wind up seeing an asymmetry on one side. Now, in 1979, Jean-Pierre Lumenet, who was himself kind of a visionary, made the first simulations of what a black hole might look like, and he took a thin disk around a black hole and showed very clearly that some of the light rays are bent above the black hole, some below the black hole, and you wind up with a characteristic kind of interstellar image, which we see from that 2014 movie. And he even got this right here. There's a little disk in here, a little line here, which shows the last photon orbit. And Jean-Pierre was very passionate. He made the first true image of what a black hole would look like. These dots are all hand-drawn with India ink on Canson negative paper in 1979. And then, not content to do that, he made the first animation of this. So really, hats off to Jean-Pierre for sticking with this. And this, again, is that last photon orbit. And the reason you have a space in between here is because the disk itself is truncated before it gets to that last photon orbit. Now, if you want to know viscerally what's happening, you can formally ray trace photons from all directions around the black hole, and then you wind up getting this screen here, which is what we would see. And you have the photon orbit clearly shown in this circular feature here with wispy tendrils of emission, which will become very important later on the outer parts. And this is what we're hoping to measure. If we could lay a ruler across space-time, this would be a measurement of the mass of the black hole, but also validation of Einstein's theory to some precision, and we'll talk about that. A number of groups theory groups over the years, starting in 2000, coming on to 2009 and beyond, have asked what would the black hole look like if you truly put it into a soup of hot plasma, the one expects around an astrophysical black hole. You wind up seeing the shadow feature. One side is typically brighter than the other because the Doppler boosting of the emission coming around the black hole at near light speed makes it brighter. So one side is typically dim, one side is typically bright, and there are many, many dynamical simulations of black holes now that, in addition to being very instructive, are quite beautiful. Now, the first object that one can think of doing this for is the supermassive black hole in the center of our Milky Way galaxy. And Andrea Ghez and Reinhard Genzel won the Nobel Prize recently for this work. You can see that in the center of the Milky Way galaxy, if you look at it in the radio and you zoom in, you see tendrils of hot ionized gas falling into the center. This bright point here, seen in 2 centimeter wavelength radio, is the supermassive black hole at the center of our Milky Way galaxy called Sagittarius A star. And the work for which Andrea Ghez and Reinhard Genzel won the Nobel Prize is shown here. They looked at the orbits of stars around an unseen mass. And as I like to say, if this doesn't knock your socks off, your socks are on too tight. Because how, you know, when do you see an orbit of a star moving around something so massive that it tosses it around like a planet? And the only thing that really makes sense here is that this must be a 4 million solar mass object that's causing these stars to move around it. And this is what we've seen with the Event Horizon Telescope, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about how we made this measurement and how it stands in relation to the predictions made by Andrea Ghez and Reinhard Genzel's work. The other thing to point out is that this is the best case we have for potentially testing GR because we know Sagittarius A star's mass better than we know our own. So if you step on a scale, you kind of have some idea of how much you weigh, but we know Sagittarius A star's mass to probably better than 1% at this point. So a measurement of the size, if we could measure truly the size of the photon orbit, would be a very precise test of Einstein's theory. Now, the next best source for doing this is 55 million light years further away. It's M87. And if you look at M87 on large size scales, you see that it powers an extragalactic jet that pierces the entire galaxy, moves out, you know, many thousands of light years. You zoom in by factors of 10,000. And you still see this self-similar jet, very well collimated, ostensibly powered by twisting magnetic field lines that centrifugally accelerate charged particles from the north and south pole of this black hole. But you don't resolve what's happening in the very, very center here, even getting down to 86 gigahertz on a global array. With the Event Horizon Telescope, we were able to finally resolve what happens in here, and we see very clearly this ring, and we'll talk more about what we've learned from there. And this is what you see in the optical. This was already known in 1918. Curtis imaged this jet coming from this source, and they had no idea what it was, of course. So imagine seeing that in 1918, wondering what is happening. Why is there this linear source coming from the center of this galaxy? So a few things have to go right in order to make a picture of a black hole. This is going to be a little bit of a history of how we thought about this project. So first, you have to make sure that you can see all the way to the center of the galaxy. Now, the galaxy is filled with gas, and right around the supermassive black hole, this gas is heated to hundreds of billions of degrees. So the question is this gas transparent? And at what wavelengths does it begin to be transparent? This is a spectrum of Sagittarius A star, and you see it's rising here. It's optically thick in the centimeter and the beginning of the millimeter, but right around 1 millimeter, it begins to turn over and become optically thin. So a priori, you would expect that at around 1 millimeter wavelength, you'd begin to have this turnover here. You would begin to be able to see through all of this gas. You could do it at higher frequencies, of course, but the reason the radio is interesting is because we have techniques that give us access to ultra-high angular resolution. So it's this mixture of becoming transparent and high angular resolution that steers us to the radio. And in this simulation, you see we start at longer wavelengths where it's optically thick. And around 1 millimeter, that I'm showing you here, you begin to see all the way to the event horizon. And this is where the dynamics of the motion around the black hole can be studied. So 1.3 millimeter wavelength is really the Goldilocks wavelength that we're targeting. Now, another thing that makes this difficult is if you try to see through to the center of our galaxy, 1,000 times closer into the black hole than those stars that Ghez and Genzel were seeing, you have a problem. Because at 3 millimeters, the best simulations we have do show that ring, but it's scattered by the interstellar medium. Free electrons between us and the galactic center create this shower curtain or shower screen kind of turbulence that prevents us from seeing the shadow. At 1.3 millimeter, we begin to see the shape of this shadow, which allows us to test Einstein's theory here. If we could get to 0.8 millimeters, this scattering, which is a lambda squared phenomenon, would be so reduced that we'd be able to see sharp features around even Sagittarius A star. So this all steers us to about 1 millimeter wavelength, or a little bit shorter to make these measurements. Now, you also need high angular resolution. So the event horizon of Sagittarius A star is about 50 microarcseconds across. And for M87, it would be about 42 microarcseconds. That's that square root of 27 times the Schwarzschild radius. So to see this is kind of the equivalent of being able to see a tangerine on the moon or your favorite citrus, whatever that citrus happens to be. I've heard a number of other possibilities. It's being able to see an atom at arm's length, or it's being able to read the date on a quarter if you're standing in New York and the quarter is in Los Angeles. But you get the idea. We're trying to get the highest angular resolution possible from the surface of our planet. And we do this with very long baseline interferometry. We start with radio telescopes that are geographically completely separable, very distant from each other. We record the radio waves from the black hole, time tagging them with a hydrogen Maser clock, which is accurate to about 1 second every 10 million years. They're recorded on hard drives once they're digitized, and we ship them all to a central correlation facility. And this makes sense. This is kind of what an optical telescope does. An optical telescope has a perfect parabolic shape. Light rays bounce off of the surface, and they combine at the focus at exactly the same time based on the surface shape of this mirror or lens, and that's where you put your camera. In the same way, we have a supercomputer here which does nothing but correlate the data and slide it back and forth in time and in frequency, looking for peaks in correlation. And that then combines these data to form a telescope as large as the distance between these telescopes. A couple of points here. There's no compression possible. We have to ship petabytes of data because until you correlate the data, you have to keep all of the Nyquist sampling. So you need petabytes of data. After you correlate it, then you can reduce it down to about a terabyte of data. So a huge decompression in data, but you need to send all this data back. In order to get these angular resolutions at 1 millimeter wavelength, you of course need an Earth-spanning telescope. Now thankfully, for a number of reasons, the Earth rotates. Because if you only had two telescopes, that wouldn't be enough, because each pair of telescopes gives you one Fourier component of the brightness on the sky. You can think of these two telescopes as being a double-slit experiment, but run in reverse. Okay, it gives you one Fourier component of what you're seeing on the screen in a double-slit experiment. So having multiple telescopes and having the Earth rotate to change the look direction of each of these baseline pairs fills in this Earth-sized aperture. So what you're seeing here is each point is a baseline pair. It changes in orientation and direction as the Earth rotates, and each point represents one Fourier component. So it's the Fourier inverse transform of all the data on this plane that gives you the image. And if we have enough of a filling factor here, we'll be able to make a very, very good image. Now, the next last piece of this historically was this possible? I mean, yes, maybe we could see to the center of the Milky Way galaxy, maybe we could make this technique work, but was nature going to be kind to us? Was it going to present something that could be seen? Was there some factor we didn't understand that was going to prevent this from happening? So we did our first experiment that detected horizon scale structure in 2007. We linked telescopes in California, Arizona, and in Hawaii. And the idea here was that if Sagittarius A star had a finite size, the short baseline here, which has an angular resolution of lambda over d, would have seen all the energy of the source. So this is kind of pictorially shown here. The interferometric beam is larger than the source itself, so you get all the energy. But the long baselines, lambda over d, would have resulted in a much smaller beam and would have excluded some of the flux. So you'd get a much lower flux density measurement, and that's exactly what we saw. On the Arizona to California baselines, we recovered almost all of the single dish flux density of the source. On the longer baselines from Arizona to Hawaii, we saw a marked decrease in the amount of energy seen on the long baselines. And this then gave us a robust size of 3.7 Schwarzschild radius. So we knew right away there was something very small towards Sagittarius A star, and this really launched the entire effort, because now we had the technique, we had the predictions, and we were free to start aggregating more telescopes so we could make an image. The same thing happened with M87 just a couple of years later. We did the same exact measurement. This is a much different source, much is about 1,000 times more massive. It has this jet feature here, but still we saw something very, very small at the very center, this time about 5.5 Schwarzschild radii. So now we had two sources to look at while we were building out this entire array. Now, the other thing that made this possible historically was 13-year-old gamers, frankly, because the only way to get the bandwidth that would give us the sensitivity increase we required by recording huge swaths of the radio spectrum was by harnessing commercial off-the-shelf technology. So instead of developing this bespoke electronics in the lab, we bought commodity electronics, put them together, and the real capital expense was the software required to make these new instruments. And so you wind up getting here in the early days when I was a graduate student. We had reel-to-reel tape recorders, analog electronics, recording at sub-gigabits per second, and that simply was not enough sensitivity to make these measurements. The next big jump was to use field-programmable gate arrays, so that entire floor-to-ceiling rack of analog electronics fits in this little chip underneath this heat sink, and instead of reel-to-reel recorders, we recorded on hard disks. And now this is the modern day, which is now at each of the Event Horizon Telescope sites, and we were recording at 32 gigabits per second here, but now we are recording at 64 gigabits per second. So over the course of a decade, we kept track with Moore's Law, shown here in blue. That's kind of remarkable. So riding this technological wave, we were able to generate the sensitivities needed to image a black hole. The last piece of the puzzle, which I feel really needs to be mentioned, is that in addition to bandwidth, we needed raw steel. I mean, having bandwidth is great, but the sensitivity only goes as a square root of bandwidth. But with steel, you're actually getting more photons, so it goes as the collecting area of your telescope. And the ALMA array was just coming online at 60 dishes at the high Atacama Desert. And if we could phase all of these together, we would have gotten the equivalent of a 75-meter dish at the best location on the planet. And that would have increased our sensitivity at one single stroke by a factor of 10. So over the course of about 8 years, we designed and put together a separate international collaboration just to phase up this instrument. And that was done just in time in 2017 to take these measurements. In April of 2017, we used all of these sites, the LMT in Mexico, the SMT in Arizona, two sites, SMA and JCMT on Mauna Kea in Hawaii, APEX and ALMA in Chile, the South Pole Telescope at the South Pole, and the IRAM 30 meter in Spain. We had wonderful weather. We detected Sag A star and M87 at all of these sites, all the baselines we detected it. And this was really the beginning of these results that I'm going to show you now. Now, when I say that we ship data around and many petabytes, I'm not joking. We take hard disks and we crate them. And this is Andrew at the South Pole putting all of the data into a crate. Here it is arriving at Haystack Observatory with a FedEx truck. It's being unloaded with a forklift. How often do you see photons being unloaded with a forklift? I mean, I know that with ultra-fast laser pulses, we can slow it down and watch it, right? But here we're just, workaday forklifts. Here we're unpacking it, and here they're warming up because you don't want to play back a hard disk when it's cold. This is not meant to be funny. Even though it's kind of funny, but getting this, the logistics for this done, as Art was mentioning for snow, is a real feat. I mean, generating the logistics to get all these petabytes of data out, record them and back, requires real precision and a dedicated team. We're not the first people to ship data around like this. This is 5 megabytes of storage in 1956 from IBM, okay? So what's old is new, we're just making it smaller and a little bit faster. Now, when we first got the data, again, this is a bit of a historical talk, we saw right away that there was something very interesting about these data. okay? I showed you before what our first test had. Again, I'm showing the energy detected on a baseline here and the baseline length, exactly what I showed you before. And we tried fitting this with a Gaussian, and of course, you just can't do it because there's substructure here in the Fourier domain. When you start getting a hard edge with a filled disk, you begin to see these nulls associated with the ringing at these boundaries. But it's only when you look at a ring that you begin to get the spacing of these nulls right. And when you get an asymmetric ring like this, then you can fit a whole family of curves here. And a number of people here in Perimeter, working with Avery, did a lot of work to refine this model fitting technique. So we knew right away we had something, but then we wanted to move to imaging. Now, one of the problems here is that we have a lot of Fourier components, and each of these you can see here are labeled with the baseline pair that they correspond to. But there's a lot of open spaces in here. There's a lot of places we don't know what the data would tell us. So we use this technique of chi-squared fitting, but also using regularizers in an RML sense, the regularized maximum likelihood method. And we make some assumptions about what's happening in here, but very, very basic assumptions, like the fact that the image has to be positive, and it can't be complex valued on the image plane. And using just very slight regularizers, because we had such a strong signal, we immediately converged on a ring-like image like this, which had a very carefully defined size. Now, how good are these images? Well, we spent 2 to 3 years doing nothing but testing images. And you know, Katie Bauman, who was a graduate student, then a postdoc, and now faculty at Caltech, led something that we called the imaging challenges. And we started with giving a blind test. So everyone got the same data. It was all synthetic data. And these are the images that came from all 6 teams working on the data. And this was the input image. So many times, if you had a very clear ring, you would wind up getting clear results. Sometimes the results were not so good, depending on which algorithm that you chose. And here you can see the reason why. We're using a general relativistic magnetohydrodynamic simulation that has these wisps of material because we're looking down the jet. So in complex cases, some of our initial algorithms were fooled. And then, of course, we had some interesting tests like this one. I'm sure you can all guess what this is. This is Frosty the Snowman. Okay, so occasionally we would send in something that was completely unexpected. And people had to, without bias, reproduce exactly what they saw. And for some people who came from places that it never snowed, they had no idea what they were looking for. Right. So we split up into 4 teams, and this gets back to something that we talked about last night and something that Art touched on, this blindness in science. You have to try to double blind everything. So we understood that everybody would want to see a ring, and we wanted to split up into 4 teams so that none of the teams talked to each other. They all got the data. They all used different techniques. And they all needed to come together at the end of this process to show what they had. I show this sometimes because the reason we do this is because labradoodles look a lot like fried chicken. And if you think you're looking at fried chicken, you could be looking at a labradoodle. And of course, chihuahuas and blueberry muffins are virtually impossible to tell the difference between. Thanks for not laughing. The reason I show this is that this is a real thing. Like, bias in science is absolutely critical. And because we knew that we had something very interesting with this Fourier ringing, we needed to make sure that what we came with was robust. So on July 24th, all 4 of these teams came together. And in one moment, we revealed all of these, similar to what Art was talking about with the neutrino result. And everyone found a ring, all the same diameter with different levels of fidelity. And we spent the next 6 months trying to make this go away. So we did everything that we could, modeling with doubles, filled disks, anything that we could model it with. And these results stood the test of time. In addition, we looked at calibrator sources for which we would expect to see a core and a jet, like 3C279, a well-known quasar, for which we see a very collimated jet. And then we did see the expected core and jet structure in all of the different techniques that we used. This was also repeatable over many days. So we had 4 different days of data, all completely distinct. While the UV coverage, while the Fourier coverage was similar in all of these 4 days. It was different, and all the errors and all the thermal noise was different, and each time we got a different image. If you watch this carefully, if you look carefully from April 5th to April 11th, you'll see some differences. There's some shifting of the brightness around. This could be the motion at near light speeds of hot plasma around the black hole, but we'll need to take many more epochs of data in order to make our first movie of M87. Now, I want to talk for a minute about the importance of sites, because we started small. Our team was very, very small at the very, very beginning, and we had only a few sites. And with a few sites like this, one baseline, for example, using the data that we have, these are images made with just a small amount of data, you can only tell roughly what the size of the image is. If you extend this along this linear line from the United States and Mexico to Chile, you get a more finely grained image, but you can't tell the structure. It's when you start to get an outrigger here to Hawaii, you begin to see the beginnings of this ring. But it's only when you have the full array in 2017 that you can make a ring-like image like this. So it's really location, location, location when you're talking about very long baseline interferometry. And we'll come back to that at the very end when we talk about the next generation instrument that we're planning. So what did we measure? There's a number of ways you can fit the data. So you could fit directly from the Fourier domain to a ring, and you could measure it that way. You could use general relativistic magnetohydrodynamics, and you could fit directly to those kinds of models. What I'm going to show you here is fitting to the image. So you make an image, and then you trace around in azimuth, and you wind up getting, as a function of azimuthal angle, the radius, but also the thickness of the disk. And that's shown down here and up here. And for a Schwarzschild radius black hole, we would expect, as I showed you at the very beginning, a very simple relationship between the angular size we're measuring here and the Schwarzschild radius, so 2 times the square root of 27, gm over dc squared. Why d? Because we don't know how far away the black hole is. We're measuring an angular size. Okay? So we need to know the distance to this source in order to conduct this test. And that comes into the ultimate error bar that I'll show you in a moment. And we think about the angular gravitational radius, theta sub g here, as just shorthand for all this. Now, the problem is one of bias. So at the top here, you see one of the general relativistic magnetohydrodynamic frames that fits the data. And you can see in white here that photon orbit. So we want to measure the photon orbit, but you can see there's wisps of emission outside that because of the turbulent nature of the hot gas orbiting the black hole. So when you make the image and you send this white ring down below, when you measure the ridge line, as I just showed you, it's typically going to be larger than the actual photon orbit. So the question that faced our team was, how do you account for this bias? How do you get the true estimate of the photon orbit when you're measuring something that's a little bit larger? And the answer was, we ran hundreds of GRMHG simulations, ran those synthetic data with appropriate errors, and we were very careful to make those errors look exactly like the instrumental errors that we were getting from the EHT, and we would make an image, trace the ridge line, and then compare with the known photon orbit, because we knew what it was from the GRMHD. And we ran this over and over and over again. And after hundreds of simulations, we wound up getting this factor, alpha here, which tracked the gravitational angular size to the size we were actually measuring. And this is a very, you know, interesting plot. This shows that theta G that we're measuring as a function of date with different data sets. And each of these lines here shows a different technique used to image the black hole. And we're getting a very consistent size of the theta G across all of these using this empirically determined alpha. And since we know the distance of 16.8 megaparsecs to M87, we're able now to read off the mass, which is 6.5 billion solar masses. So using this technique, debiasing in this way using theory, we come with the mass of M87 to within about 10 or 15%. So this was the test. And because this mass matches the dynamical mass, it's measured from the motions of stars around the supermassive black hole out around 1 kiloparsec, this is a very strong test that verifies GR and also measures the mass of this black hole in an entirely new way. So to summarize what we've learned about M87, we have the mass from GR measurements. It agrees with all the dynamical measurements of the motions of stars around the central cluster. This is circular to within about 10%, and that's to be expected, because the jet in M87 is almost coming directly to you. So you're looking down the throat of this jet. You expect to see this circular size. But you also see an asymmetry, because you're seeing some of the gas move around the black hole at near light speeds. So using the right-hand rule, you take your thumb, point it in this direction, your fingers are curling around the bottom, and you expect to see Doppler boosting on the bottom, Doppler deboosting on the top, and for the first time we're measuring the spin direction of this supermassive black hole. So it's pointed into the page at about 17 degrees off to the left. So this is the first time we've actually been able to measure the spin direction of a supermassive black hole in this way, just by looking at the asymmetry of this ring. We're testing Einstein's theory at about the 17% level, and as I'll explain in a few minutes, we can do much better with future observations. Now for Sagittarius A star, which we came with a couple of years later, it was much more difficult. First, we had to deal with the scattering, but also Sagittarius A star being 1,000 times less massive changes its appearance moment to moment on the sky. So we can no longer add all of the Fourier data from an evening of observations. We have to make snapshots about every 5 minutes to subsample, in a Nyquist sense, the orbits that we're seeing here. So this is very, very challenging. And one of the ways we dealt with this, and again, a lot of work on this was done here at Perimeter, is we made many, many images trying to use different models of the source. So we could have modeled it with a ring, but we also tried using a crescent, a simple disk, an elliptical disk, a point source with a halo, a double GRMHD, and we trained each of these techniques so that they were specialized on these different models, okay? And we used different techniques to recover with synthetic data, and in each case, we always came back to this ring. So we're very, very confident that even with this changing data as a function of time, we have robustly detected this ring. And I'll tell you a little bit about the azimuthal distribution of the brightness in a moment, but the ring is a very, very solid result from Sagittarius A star. So we detected 4 major clusters. So you always see this ring for the first 3, but where the brightness is around the ring changes, and you can see here in these bar charts the relative frequency. So the first 3 are the most frequent. We always seem to get a ring. There's one case here where we seem to get a non-ring morphology, but it only happens about 2% of the time. Now, the interesting thing about this is you might look at this 2% and say, well, your results are not very sound. They're not very robust. But it turns out that the ring structure that we're seeing here is not likely produced by intrinsic non-ring morphology, for the simple reason that when you put through a lot of synthetic data through our process and you always have a ring, you get about 2% non-ring results. So you expect there to be a 2% failure rate even when there is a ring. So this is very consistent with there being a ring and just seeing about 2% of the time you don't get them. Now, just to give you an idea of how close this is, how are we doing?
Bad.
Oh, bad, okay. All right, okay, so I'm just gonna say that here's the prediction from these stars. This is what we measured, okay, so we're doing pretty well. And I'm not gonna go through all this except to say that at this point, this is the best evidence that we have for supermassive black holes, bar none. I'm just gonna say a few words about the next generation EHT. So again, it's all location, location, location. We wanna make movies of black holes. So we've been surveying all of these sites in red around the globe. I actually just came back from Kilimanjaro, where we are thinking about putting a dish in one of the locations there. If we populate the globe with another 10 dishes, this is the filling factor we get for all the UV spacings. So instead of getting large holes, we get almost complete coverage by going to higher frequencies and filling out the Earth-sized virtual lens. We're able to make a map now not only of the black hole, but of the faint jet that goes off to the side. And you can see here what the process looks like as we converge on that image. And what's more, we'll be able to make movies. So by the end of this decade, we will make movies of black holes at this level. And we will trace the flow of energy from the black hole all the way out at this level of fidelity. Now, for Sagittarius A star, it's harder. We have to make snapshots. So at any given moment, our Fourier coverage changes, but with all of the new sites and the new frequencies, here's the simulation, this is the blurred simulation, this is the reconstruction. We'll be able to trace the motion in real time of matter around Sagittarius A star. And that's important because while the spin of the black hole doesn't affect the size of the lensed photon orbit, the innermost stable circular orbit period, the time it takes matter to orbit the black hole, is exquisitely sensitive to spin. So measuring this orbital period is a way of measuring fundamental spin parameters, and it's a separate test of GR. And last, that photon ring I showed you is really made up of an infinite series of rings. The first ring that we see mostly is lightly lensed around the black hole. Then you get some photons that make a U-turn around the black hole, and they're much more tightly coupled to the metric of thin ring. And then you get an N equals two ring for the loop-to-loop photons. And we think that with the NGHT, we'll be able to recover that. So by the end of this decade, we should be seeing the N equals one ring and making precision measurements of black holes. I'm not going to go into this, but there's space with four orbiters. We fill in that UV plane in about 1 hour, allowing us to make really precise movies. And if we had a telescope at the second Lagrange point, tens of thousands of black holes could be brought into range. So a lot of interesting things to think about. So this is the model. With the next generation EHT, we hope to do this. And with space, this is roughly what we're getting. I want to point out this is a team effort. We started small, but to image the black hole, we had to grow to over 200 members. Now we're over 300 members. This is one of our meetings. And early career scientists played a vast role in this. So if you are an early career scientist, a postdoc, or a graduate student, know that you can make seminal contributions to an interesting project like this at the early part of your career. And then there's this human dimension. Somehow this has captured the imagination of a lot of people. And I'm a big Jeopardy fan, and I'm really glad that this was one of the questions asked by Alex Trebek at the very end. So I'll end there. Thank you very much.
Maybe while Kendrick sets up his computer, we have time for one question. Given my previous attempt, I'll try again. No? Oh, okay.
Sorry about that.
I think I should, but okay. From here I can? I'll do it.
Okay. My question is this. Suppose we have not discovered GR here. Suppose we have not discovered GR. Is it possible, just purely by signal processing techniques, to detect black hole images or not?
I think what you're saying is, if we hadn't predicted this, would we have seen it at some point? Is that what you're saying? Yeah, we absolutely would have seen this. It turns out that regardless of the idea of what the image of a black hole would look like, people were already racing to resolve Sagittarius A star for a number of reasons, right? So we knew there was something compact there. Mostly that was fueled by the study of accretion processes around black holes. But for example, my thesis was on 3 millimeter VLBI of Sag A star, and we were naturally moving to higher frequencies. So this probably would have happened anyway, but the GR and the predictions from GR gave us a really clear goal to shoot for. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.